This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to The Great Indoors,
the podcast which reveals everything you ever needed to know about interiors and explains how to make it all really work for you in your home.
I'm Kate Watson-Smythe.
And I'm Sophie Robinson. And you can sign up to The Great Indoors Insiders to support the podcast, enjoy ad-free listening, bonus content and get first dibs on ticketed events. Just go to thegreatindoorspodcast.com. That's thegreatindoorspodcast.com.
Now, before we begin the show, we wanted to introduce you to our lovely sponsors, Causton Architectural Detail, makers of a beautiful collection of coordinating sockets and switches, handles and hinges, and lighting for both indoors and outdoors.
Oh, let's talk about lighting, because after last week's garden chat, I'm excited to do all things design in my garden, and I think lighting is going to be key.
We had supper with friends recently, actually, and I noticed that while it was too cold to sit outside, they had their garden lights on, even though we were inside, and it was such a pretty view looking out from the kitchen to the trees and plants outside. I think garden lighting is so often overlooked.
Yeah, I think this is interesting because a lot of people go to the expense of installing huge glass doors and windows, and while they look fabulous in the daytime, you're just kind of like faced with this huge expanse of black darkness in the evening. And just by installing a few garden lights can make a huge difference to creating some depth while you're sitting inside.
And talking of inside, Causton's lighting range not only works outside but is also rated for bathroom use as well. I have a couple of their bronze wall lights either side of the mirror in my bathroom.
Oh yes, top tip, side lighting is always so much more flattering than overhead. So if you are doing your bathroom, try to add a couple of lights either side of the mirror. It'll get you off to a better start to your day.
You're not wrong. What's that thing people say? I'm much nicer when I light my outfit. Well, I'm much nicer if the bathroom lighting has been kind to me first thing in the morning.
For more information on Causton's lighting range, visit causton.com and look out for their paintable spotlights as well. You can paint them to match the walls and ceiling so they disappear, or pick a contrasting colour to show them off. I know which one I'd do.
And I'd do the opposite. Now, what have we got coming up on the show today?
We're going to be diving into the latest interior design book releases, including one by yourself, I think.
I'm kind of excited and a bit scared to hear what you think. But before that, just as I come to the end of my building work in London, I see you've got a 3 metre hole in your wall, possibly even two.
I've got two. I know, exactly. So part of our internal reshuffle, as I've already talked about, swapping our kitchen and living room over, essentially. So we're getting a nice big kitchen dining room down the south end of the house. I wanted the view to go with.
Yeah, but you never mentioned the bedroom. It was all about the kitchen view. And then suddenly you've knocked your bedroom down.
Well, it's all part of the planning permission. When we had the planning permission for our extension, we also did put in planning to replace these windows. And also, you know, while Tom's out there with his sledgehammer,
well, that's true.
Think as also from an exterior point of view, to put new aluminium doors on the ground floor and leave the little tiny PVC window upstairs would look really wrong.
I know what this is. This is a long-term plan by you
to change all the windows,
to get rid of all the UPVC windows, which Tom said he wouldn't do because he couldn't see that there was a valid reason for getting rid of them. So you're just redesigning the house and he's got no choice. I see your plan, Tom, if you're listening.
He's been rumbled. Well, the windows we've knocked out are on the sort of 1980s extension end of the house. So the Victoriana plastic windows are in the old part of the house. They are actually staying put at the moment. But in the sort of the 80s extension part of this whole remodel that we put planning in was to actually change the windows. So yeah, we are on a big drive not to spend too much money, but then it's always that balance, isn't it, of like, well, if we don't do it now, it's going to be twice as expensive to do it later. So yeah, unfortunately my poor darling builder husband is working all week and then coming home weekends and evenings and doing stuff on the house, because we just found out that the windows arrive on Thursday, which is actually when this podcast goes out.
Oh,
so listeners, as you're listening to this on Thursday, my windows will have arrived.
Well, you say that. Last time we were recording, if you remember, I was waiting for my worktop to arrive. And then, you know, there was a big question as to whether it was Tom's truck that was blocking my worktop. But yes, I can tell listeners that the worktop did arrive very late that day and it is now in situ.
And I've seen a sneaky picture. It looks lovely. So anyway, your build is old news now and you've got new news. What's this I saw on Instagram of a little picture of you in Turin?
Well, I mean, as you know, and listeners will know, the point of selling our big London house last year was so that we might be able to buy a place in Italy, which we've been talking about for 30 years, ever since I first met my husband. And I think we sort of thought, you know, that it would happen. We'd win in the lottery, or we, you know, we would just have the money to do it. But it became apparent over the last 30 years that wasn't going to happen like that. So we sold our big London house and bought a smaller one so that we would be able to house hunt in Italy. And it's been going on for a long time. We first saw it almost exactly a year ago in the pouring rain. And we looked at it and we thought, you know, this is a little bit too big. It's not what we were looking for. And then we both burst into tears and we just kind of completely fell in love with it, sort of slightly against all rhyme and reason. I mean, we'd been very focused in our search because obviously house hunting in a different country, you can't just go and see, you know, wander over and see one and then pop over and see another 2 days later. So we'd done that thing where we'd looked at hundreds of houses online and then we went over for a visit and we went to see a remote farmhouse and a country estate and a small townhouse. So we were kind of narrowing in on types. And this was a house in a village and we both loved it online, but we thought it might be too big. We weren't sure of the state of it. We needed to check the location and we went to see it in the pouring rain. It was like that. It was like the end scene of Four Weddings and a Funeral where it's pouring with rain and they're all crying. And we were doing that and we were just like, oh, this is the house. And that was the before we'd even seen inside. And then we obviously couldn't offer because we hadn't finalised the London sale. So we spent 6 months sort of trying to keep the estate agent warm, but not being able to make a formal offer whilst trying to talk ourselves out of it. Mm-hmm. But the reality of these things in Italy is that small houses often cost more because there's more demand. And we couldn't have afforded, you know, a flat in Turin. Not that we wanted that because we live in London. So we wanted something with gardens and a bit more space. But, you know, it's quite a commitment. But so it's got a certain amount of work to do. But there were other little practical things, like it's got a garden, but it's not got grass. So, you know, you think if you're going to visit somewhere for the weekend and you've got to spend all weekend mowing the grass, then that takes away from time you're spending being in the house. So this is what I believe the phrase is, Italianate gardens, which basically means it's got gravel and trees and shrubs and things. So it's much easier to manage. And, you know, we've worked out a plan of how we can make it earn its living. So location shoots and possibly even rent some of it out. It was divided into two, which is very common with big Italian houses. They sell them as what they call bi-family houses. And that's where they've divided it into flats or divvied it up so that the extended family can live in it and have their own private pieces. And that's what had happened here. And we have an architect out there and we had long conversations with her about how we would reunite it and join the staircase back up. And actually, we've decided we're going to leave it like that because there's a door that divides the two. So you can leave it open and it can be one, or you can close it. But it means we can run the heating separately, or we could just rent out the top floor for holidays or work retreats or something. So each time we kept thinking, this is a ridiculously impractical house. The house would send us another idea for, here's a plan. This is what I can do for you. This is how you can work it. So we're all go. We met the builders last week after we'd picked up the keys. It needs a complete rewire.
Kate, I cannot believe you're going from one build.
I know.
Hurtling, which has nearly destroyed you, hurtling into a second one that's like not even in this country. I suppose you speak good Italian, right?
I do speak good Italian. Our architect, Sara Fronduti, speaks very good English. And it was just, I mean, that's just the way it happens, isn't it?
It's so brilliant. I love it.
Well, it's, I mean, it is, I am terrified of it. But at the same time, that was just, that's just the way it's gone, you know, because we've had to throw everything up in the air. We could have, you know, if this house hadn't presented itself, we wouldn't have done it. We'd have carried on looking for a year or 2 years. But equally, that's the way it went. So we've had to sort of throw everything up in the air, and it's going to be exhausting. But next year will be sorted. And I'm very conscious as well. I mean, I don't know the average age of our listeners. I think it really varies. But obviously, I make no secret of the fact that I'm 56. You know, we've got friends who were in their early 60s, and they were talking about a friend who was doing a big renovation and saying that she was just quite tired. And I'm very conscious. I don't want to be in my late 50s doing all this work and not having the energy, or finding that we haven't got a long time to be in it. So it's like, OK, I still feel exhausted, but I'm able to do it and we can do it. Let's get it done. And then it's done.
Oh, no, I love it. I love it. I love it. You know, you talk about it being a 30-year dream. I can absolutely imagine that this is going to be a dream. I'm here for the dream, Kate. I'm here for the
Excellent.
Ride. You're going to be sharing here, obviously, on the podcast, the developments, and over on Instagram too, I'm sure. I mean, obviously, you've already shared some pictures on Insta. It does look absolutely dreamy. I mean, that, what is it, 100-year-old wisteria or something that's just come out in full bloom. What a housewarming gift that is to arrive and pick up your keys.
I took pictures of it with the bees in it, and I sent them to the granddaughter of the owner of the house, the nonna, the grandmother, and she's moved into a small flat in Turin, and apparently she's using those pictures as the backdrop on her tablet now, which is really sweet. And she's invited us for tea next time we're over, so we're going to go and take tea with her and talk to her about updating the house, because she's lived in it since 1964. And I pretty much think the kitchen is the original.
Brilliant. Ah, well, you've got us all on the edge of our seats for the next instalment.
Yes, it's going to be fun.
So the topic of today's episode is a roundup of all the latest interior design books that have been launched or are about to be launched around this time. It's a popular time of year, isn't it, for book launches? And we've got four titles to share with you today. We've got Home the Way We Live Now by a certain Kate Watson Smythe. We've got The 70s House by Estelle Bilson. We've got The Handbook of Home Design by Laura Jane Clark. And Interior Design Masters by Joanna Thornhill. But I think, Kate, we should kick off, should we not, with your latest home. Is this book number four? Am I keeping count?
Technically, it's number five, but the first one was all about Shades of Grey, so you don't have to acknowledge that one if you don't want to.
Yeah, I kind of forgot about that one.
Yeah, I thought you might.
Book number five. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. That is so impressive. Okay, so first of all, first impressions. It's a big book, because books are just getting tinier and tinier and tinier, aren't they? But this one is big. Yeah. A4-ish size. And it's got a ring binder as well, which is a bit different. And then the other thing, which I've just got to go straight in with, is you've sliced it up into three different kind of topics. The first one is called The Small Home. The second one is called Working From Home. And the third section is called The Rented Home. And already I'm seeing this is very much a comment, isn't it, on the way we live now. Homes getting smaller, more of us working from home, more of us renting. So I'm guessing that's the premise for the whole book, right?
Well, this was the thing. I mean, I had long conversations with my publisher, which actually started in the very first lockdown in 2020. This has taken a long time to come together. And we were discussing what to write about. And I felt very much that those three issues were affecting the way we live now, the key issues for 21st century living. And so my publisher was like, right, well, let's write a book and wind all those things into it. And what I then quickly realised was that they overlap, because you could live in a big house, but it's bound to have small rooms in it. You might have just bought your first house and want to kind of make the kitchen okay while you save up the money to do the work. So you might apply the principles of rented decor to that because you don't want to spend too much money, or you want to be able to reverse it, or you want just a sort of clever temporary idea. And obviously working from home can happen in every room in the house. So what I thought was, if we had a traditional book, which was just in thirds, you'd be constantly flipping between all those sections and you'd need post-it notes and ribbons and all sorts to kind of find your way around it. So what we did was slice the pages. I remember a cookbook from the 1970s by Arabella Boxer, and this is very much in homage to that. And it was called First Slice Your Cookbook. And the pages were divided into three, and they were starters, main courses, and puddings. And the idea was that you could flick through and choose your starter, pick your main course, and then finalise it with a pudding. So it was a personalised menu. And I thought that concept would work really well for this book because it's colour-coded. So you could read it all the way through like a book on small homes or all about rented homes. Or you can flip to all the yellow sections, which might be small kitchens. And then there's a section where you might have yellow rented kitchens. So you can read about small rented kitchens, or you can read about small rented living rooms, or just rented living rooms where you want to work from home and create a space for working from home. So all the overlapping is done by you basically personalising the book to what you need so you can read it. It's a bit sort of Sudoku-like. It was what my publisher said when she was slightly crying on the bus on the way home one night. Because I think it's been, you know, shout out to the design team at Pavilion. It's been a nightmare for them, but I think it works because this is a book that you can personalise for what you need.
Well, I think that's in the title, isn't it? Home, the way we live now. And what you sort of highlighted is we all live really different lives, actually, and it's about tailor making our home to suit our purposes, isn't it? You've got some, oh, there's some stats in this book, Kate.
Oh, there's a few stats.
Oh, I was like, there she is, she loves a stat. I was really interested about this whole section that where you talk about homes getting smaller, prices getting higher, and there was something, I think you said here, 38% of UK housing stock being underoccupied. And you said a lot of this is because empty nesters are staying in the family home long after their adult children have left. And this whole idea that having a big house and big rooms, and rooms, in fact, that you didn't use, used to be quite a status symbol, you know, the bigger the house.
Yeah.
And that actually there's a train of thought going forward that actually that might be just really not the thing. People would be ashamed of having a really big house perhaps in the future, and it won't become this status symbol that it has been. I thought that was really interesting, especially from my point of view, I suppose, where I had bought this house in 2016 and just assumed that we were going to put an extension on it. Of course we were. We were just, you know, because the kitchen wasn't in the right place and we're just going to make the house bigger. But actually, what we've discovered through our own journey and having to cut our cloth accordingly is that we don't need more space. We need to better use of the space we have. So do you think as well that's a big sort of thread that runs through the book as well, of being clever with the space you've got?
I think it's really key. I mean, I always think back to before we bought the last house, we were looking at houses and the boys were small and we were looking at big houses because, you know, the dream was that they might have a playroom or that we would have, you know, spaces to work from home. I mean, I worked from home even then. And there was one particular house that we loved and we didn't get. And then you look back on it, and I also firmly believe you sort of get the house you're meant to have, because, you know, at the time we were looking, I think the boys were probably 10 and 8. And we knew even then that there would be a sort of small period of time before they wanted to move out or move on and have their own lives. And so we wouldn't need that much space. So there's partly, as you say, that I think that idea of status with a big house is changing, but also I think we need to get cleverer at using the spaces we've got. So in this London house that I'm doing up now, we had a fairly ropey extension on the back, which was a utility room. And the estate agent, when we came to look round, it was like, well, obviously you'll knock that down. You'll put, you know, you'll move the extension into the side return and create a big wide kitchen. And I was a bit like, well, I don't know why we would do that, because that's just spending money. It's not going to give us any more space. It's just going to give us space in a different place. So I think it's really important to, you know, as you've done by living in the house, work out where you need the space. So you're moving your kitchen from an area which was traditionally the kitchen where it didn't work to a space where it's going to work much better for you and the way you live. And that's going to cost you much less than just building an extra large one, which you don't need. We've rebranded utility room into pantries, question of words. But that has actually weirdly allowed us to have a downstairs shower room as opposed to just a tiny downstairs loo under the stairs. So it's really about, you know, do you need more space or do you just need to be cleverer with the space you've got? And that is a theme that runs through the book. Absolutely.
The other theme that runs through the book, which is quite interesting, isn't it? That you, I know you started talking about this book in 2020, which was the height of lockdowns. Everybody working from home. Well, not, you know, unless you didn't have to. And yet you've dedicated a third of this book to working from home. And that must have been quite a punt at the time, I'm guessing, you know, because at that time you didn't know. I mean, are people going to continue working from home? Is everybody just going to rush back? As it happens, people are flexi working more, aren't they? A bit at home, 2 days at home, 3 days in the office or whatever. So you sort of saw into your crystal ball that was going to become a long-term thing for people working from home.
Yes, interesting. I mean, I'd like to claim that I looked in my crystal ball. I mean, I think I've always been interested in working from home because that's what I do. And, you know, when I get called in to help people with their houses and plan their spaces, you know, I saw pre-lockdown, certainly, a lot of what people call spare rooms. And I have real issue with the word spare room because I don't think very many of us do have spare rooms. So I'm going to rebrand that to guest room. But if you like, there was a room which was for the guests who, I don't know, if you add up how many nights a year you have guests, it's probably not that many. And yet there's a huge double bed in it. And then there's a tiny desk crammed into the corner where people do their working from home. So the first thing I always say is get a sofa bed in that space because, you know, you can buy comfortable ones. So it was partly I think about working from home because I do that. I also saw, obviously, in the pandemic, we all felt that was going to become a much bigger thing. And the truth is, as you say, there's much more hybrid now. People are doing both. But it also changes in that it's also about your children. You know, if you have children, they need maybe a decent space to do homework or a space to study. So it's not just for office workers working from home. It's about places to store, even if you're working from home is your household admin. You know, you've got paperwork, you need places to store that stuff. Why not have a comfortable place to sit there and do some work rather than perching at the kitchen table? And give your children, teenagers, students who might have come back to live at home because the housing prices are so expensive, so they're having to rent, you know, that all ties back into it again. So make your home super functional for what you need.
I mean, I'm like you, I've always worked from home too. So I suppose it's always been important for me to have that space, but it's amazing how many people had never thought of it. And that, you know, in the pandemic, I suppose, threw that up, didn't it? And it just works for the way that, you know, working from home works for the way we live now, doesn't it?
Totally.
People not
totally.
Being able to afford to live in the city centres, for example, so trying to cut down on commute time, people trying to raise their children together rather than just it being taken for granted that one of the partners, usually the woman, let's be honest, is going to give up their career for a big period of time. So It is a really big move in, I would argue, the right direction. And then the third thing you write a lot about in this book is the rented home and the rise in that. And what I thought was interesting that you said at the top was a lot of the advice and ideas you've got for renters can also be applied to fixer-uppers who are looking for short-term solutions. So this whole idea of decorating for now and not sinking loads of money into the long term, I think it's a really interesting concept.
And it's also, as I say, I mean, that's why we obviously had to label the sections. And I did agonise quite a lot about whether I was going to call it rented or whether it should have something like, you know, clever design or temporary solutions. And we came back to rented because everybody understands that. But I feel it's worth explaining that, you know, you don't have to be living in rented accommodation to make these ideas work for you, because it is just about flexible things. But I've also gone into, you know, there's a chapter in there called What to Buy When You Rent, because, you know, this is where you start your furniture collection, which might become furniture that you take with you from house to house. And that then becomes, in a way, your signifiers of home. You know, if you've bought a couple of bedside tables you love, or a lamp or a small armchair, in a small rented flat, that small armchair might be your main chair. But then when you move, either into a bigger rented or perhaps you buy somewhere, that might move into a bedroom. But you unpack those things and that becomes, okay, I feel home. My walls have changed, but I still feel like I'm in my own space, in my own home. So there are certain things it's worth buying when you rent. And I go into that in the book, the sort of capsule collection of furniture. And then there's also ways where you perhaps don't want to spend a huge amount of money on certain things because you may not be able to use them. So I would say perhaps don't invest in a dining room table straight away or a big one because you might move to a smaller space or that might not fit. But a console table, which can be a breakfast bar or a desk or a hall table if you ever have a big hall. I live in a Victorian house, never going to happen. But there are certain pieces of furniture and things that it's worth investing in while you rent. And other things, temporary decoration, like the old vinyl wrap, which I did of my fridge, or people do of worktops, which you can just make a temporary makeover while you're saving to move walls or move rooms as you have done.
Brilliant. Well, I'm going to say, I mean, I am your podcast co-host. So I'm going to say you're very, very clever. And I am loving the different sections for someone like me who can feel a bit overwhelmed with pages and pages and reams of copy. It's really nice having the little sections.
It's bite-sized, isn't
it? Bite-sized. Yeah. And it's full of all your pithy, to-the-point insights. There's lots of styling tips in here. There's lots of wisdom. It's a brilliant book, Kate. It is really good. And when can people get their hands on it? I mean, I've got a preview hot for the press copy here, but when is it going to be on the bookshelves?
It's out next Thursday, the 27th of April. And you can buy it in all the usual places. And it's published by Pavilion. And I have to say again, thank you very much to them for bearing with me through this slightly complicated design. But I think it's been worth it.
Raise a glass of Pavilion. And obviously you can pre-order as well. Anybody who wants to get their hands on a first edition, you can pre-order as well online, can't you?
And pre-ordering is great for authors because it helps bookstores decide how many they want and it helps them promote it more.
Right, what should we talk about next? What about this 70s house book by Estelle Bilson?
This is just...
It's great, isn't it?
Oh, it's lovely. So it's called The 70s House by Estelle Bilson. And it's the subtitle, because all books must have subtitles now, A Bold Homage to the Most Daring Decade in Design. And it's got an orange cover and that fabulous glittery 70s font. I mean, it's just a joy.
It's got disco balls on the front cover. We should probably highlight that Estelle has got a really popular Instagram account, which I have followed for many years and very much enjoy, a 70s House Manchester, where she's detailed her own redecoration of her own home. And she is a 70s fanatic. I mean, first of all, you've got to, if you want a taste of what this book's about, check out her Instagram account. Because she's basically the authority on 70s interiors, isn't she? This is a book that's grown out of a deep, deep passion, fascination of all things 70s. And I found it really interesting. I thought I knew about the 70s a bit until I read this book. But then I kind of, you know, like all decades, of course, it blends into the 60s that came before it and into the 80s that came after it. And she's really good at carving out what this 10-year in design and indeed pop culture, of course, because it's all in the round, isn't it, had to offer. And I'm a 70s kid. I'm a 1974 child. So I've got a real affinity with this particular decade. It brought back a lot of nostalgia for me.
Well, it's interesting. Yes. So I'm a child of the 60s. So I kind of remember the 70s quite clearly. And you do sort of, you know, I look back and I remember it feeling, it did feel warm because there was a lot of orange and corduroy about and cream. So it was very much definitely a decade of warm colours, even if there were general strikes and they turned the lights off in the early 70s. But this book is, so it's a joyous nostalgia. But you know me, I love a fact. It's got so many facts in it and so many good sections. So she's got particularly a section on kitsch, which I think can be very difficult for people to pull off, because you can have kitsch which just looks sort of trashy and rubbish, but there's a real art to it. And I was just flipping through it and I saw she's got a little section on garden gnomes, which were invented in Germany and imported to England in 1850 by Sir Charles Isham, who still has his original garden gnome in the family seat of Lamport Hall in Northamptonshire. Guess how much it's worth?
What, the gnome?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. What, like loads of money? Go on, tell us.
£1 million.
No, I was not expecting you to say that.
I know.
I was not expecting you to say that.
How cool is that? It's really brilliant. And then you flip over and she's got another section on the old shag pile carpet.
Oh, yes.
Which, for those who only came to the 70s via Austin Powers, will not know so much about it. But she talks about where it came from, shag pile. I mean, I just, there's loads to learn. But it's also, this book makes me smile. Just looking at it, I'm thinking, oh, it's, you know, there's stuff to read and learn. And also, you know, how to create your own 70s style. But she's talking about what to look out for. So the old Hornsey pottery, which my grandmother had. And, you know, ceramic animals, which are the ultimate in kitsch, you know, a ceramic leopard by the fireplace. And talking about coloured vintage glass and what to look out for. So it's, you may not want to go as deep into the 70s in your home as Estelle has, but it's learning about it and bringing bits of it out into your own home, because a lot of successful interior design is about nostalgia, isn't it? You know, it's looking back to a period, and perhaps it was your childhood or your teen years, or there'll be a period where you feel comfortable. And if that for you is the 70s, then, you know, this is how to do it. Disco balls and all.
I think you're right. It's also a book that teaches you a lot about retro style and vintage. And what I hadn't realised, which I thought was really interesting, she said the 70s interiors were kind of the first decade where people got into vintage from previous decades. And I thought, my God, that's so true, because before, period styles were quite purist, weren't they? You kind of got, you know, your Art Deco, and then you moved into your mid-century modern, and they were very, you bought everything to go with that look, and you bought everything new. And she said, in with the 70s, apparently in the early 70s, it was the first ever Earth Day. People started getting really conscious about the environment, about sustainability. I was reading it and I was like, oh my God, we think we're so new. This has been going on since the 70s. And so the idea of buying secondhand, because she said before, if you had old stuff or bought secondhand, that was very much a statement on your class, as in you couldn't afford new.
Yeah.
Whereas in the 70s, it started to become cool to buy secondhand, because it was, well, first of all, yes, it was more sustainable. That message was already getting out there then. But also it was this idea of not having everything overly matchy, which is what your parents did. They went out and bought the matching G-Plan suite.
The three-piece suite. And
whereas younger people in the 70s were playing with this more, already beginning to play with this eclectic style. And on that point, she says that, you know, for anybody who says, oh, the 70s, not for me, she says it was the most stylistically diverse of decades. Everything from the cleanliness of the 60s and the early 70s, their sort of space age inspired designs, through to Art Deco inspired Big Bieber, disco and Studio 54, past Laura Ashley and what would now be termed as cottagecore, and then landing all the way up to punk. I thought, wow.
Totally. I mean, it was absolutely massive. And I don't know if who is watching or has watched Daisy Jones and the Six.
Yes, I'm currently watching that.
Just fabulous. Amazon Prime. And it was a book I read actually when it came out a couple of years ago. But the music is very Fleetwood Mac orientated. But the fashion there is full on 70s. But you can look at the houses. They live in Laurel Canyon outside LA. And you see there's throws on sofas, and there's lots of wooden furniture. And as you say, it's kind of thrifted and put together. It's absolutely a look that feels comfortable and right for now. It's a really fun book, and I think you should buy it. I think you should buy it and cheer yourself up.
I think you should buy it and cheer yourself up. And not only that, I think that's my main takeaway from it, is this isn't just for people who want to copy the 70s look. It's more about being inspired about it in the round. And I always like to have a little bit of 70s in my schemes. They just give it a bit of edge. It's never not cool, is it, the 70s? I don't know.
No, exactly.
It's one of the most endearing, I think, decades. It's got a great spirit about it.
Well, it would have been not cool. It was not cool in the 80s, because the decade before is never cool. So in the way that people were moving away from the 60s and the 70s and having more wooden furniture and warmer colours and moving away from a kind of maybe 60s plastic or that heavy leftover furniture that their parents had, the decade that immediately follows years is not cool.
There's always a reaction against it.
I mean, I left school in the mid-80s and, you know, at that point we really weren't comfortable with the idea of 70s and we were just getting into our skinny jeans and we were like, we will never wear flares again. Well, look at me. We're not filming it, but I'm wearing the most enormous pair of flared jeans today. So, you know, it is cyclical, but you find that the decade just before it tends, or the decade that just follows it, tends to look back on that and not like it. So it takes a while to come back round.
Have you got any 70s stuff?
I've got a lava lamp. I've got a lava lamp. Brilliant. And a cheese plant. So yes, but I was going to say not overtly, but you know, I've got a sort of sisal carpet in my bedroom where I'm recording now, and that's kind of textured warm 70s. So I think it's crept in a kind of reinterpreted way rather than being an actual obvious 70s. I think that influence is felt.
Interestingly, one thing that Estelle talks about a lot and I found really interesting was Terence Conran in the 70s and Habitat.
Yeah.
And heels, you know, and I just think that, you know, and they have never lost their cool edge, have they?
Exactly.
Ever since, all the way through there. So it was real pioneering stuff. And she talks about the house book, the 1974 The House Book by Terence Conran, a hefty tome which covers everything you need to know about decorating your home with confidence.
I've got it. It's a brilliant, brilliant book.
I thought you would. I did think, oh, I'm going to get myself online and see if I can. She says you can still pick up copies. But yeah, it's reignited my interest for all things 70s, I have to say. I'm going to enjoy. I haven't read the whole book. I've only had a dip in and out so far, but I'm going to really enjoy that. I think it's a good reference book for anybody who's passionate about interiors. Right, next up, we've got, I loved this book, The Handbook of Home Design, An Architect's Blueprint for Shaping Your Home by the fabulous Laura Jane Clark of BBC Two and Netflix hit TV show Your Home Made Perfect fame.
We've had her on this podcast.
I was thinking we should get her on again. This woman is just a font of all architectural knowledge. So this is a book with a lot of words, I'm not going to lie, but I could really get into this book.
I think it's really clever, but it's a teaching book, isn't it? And that's what I really like.
I've got something to learn from this book. That's what I thought. I was like, oh, look, because, you know, obviously I am more about the cushions and the colour and the decoration. This isn't a book that really goes into any of that. This is an architect's book that, well, her desire is to help you either understand enough about architecture that you can work with your architect in a more empowered way, or indeed design elements of your home yourself. But really, I think the three things that stuck out for me that she talks about are her three design rules. And she breaks it down to flow, light, and storage. And I thought, yeah, that's it right there, isn't it? Before you've even looked at paint colour or fabrics or anything else, you've got to get back down to those architectural basics.
What's so brilliant about Laura, as anyone who watched Your Home Made Perfect will remember, she's genius on storage. Absolutely brilliant at storage, about creating storage in unused spaces and also recognising the need for storage. And I think we see a lot of architect design homes which have beautiful straight lines and they look great and there's a great flow of light, and she talks about flow and light, but I think that third principle of storage often gets forgotten about, and Laura's really acutely aware that, you know, you need somewhere to put your coats, you need somewhere to put your shoes, you need somewhere to store toys if you've got children, and she never lets that go. And so she talks about those elements, and there are floor plans so you can work out how you move around your house and how the light flows. And I love this line, and this is about halfway through the book. And she says, we've looked at the concepts of flow, light and storage as separate individual elements, but now we will bring them together. There is no such thing as a wrong idea in design. It is just part of the process of getting to the right layout for you. Having said that, if you have got this far in this book and still have the door to your toilet opening in full view of your front door, we will need to have words. And I think that for me sums up this book. It's just, it will help you plan your space. And I like the confidence, you know, it's not about getting it wrong. It's just about working out what you need and taking the time.
Yeah. And it's a beautifully well-paced book as well for taking quite a complicated subject. You know, she really starts you all the way back with the basics. There are glossaries of how to understand architect's drawings, all the different symbols And outlines. There's advice on how to do your own measure drawing, as well as understanding these basic principles. It's a very, very practical book. And do you know what I sort of felt as well, flicking through it as well? Just so refreshing. It's not puff-chested, this book at all, is it?
That's a good way of putting it, yeah.
She's really like, you know what I mean? Because there's a lot, I don't know, I feel there's a lot of that going on in architecture. She's not wafting on about her shadow gaps and the purity of the light.
She designs for real people. Mm. That's what I like about it. She's not designing for those sort of people whose houses appear in magazines or who have squillions of budget to decorate their houses and create shadow gaps. She understands that people have budgets. She understands that they have mess that they don't want to throw away, but they need to put away. And she designs around that. And that's what I love about it. This is a book for real people.
I love it. All the floor plans that are included, the pictures of the homes that she included look like the average family home. They're not got huge ceilings or, you know, vaulted porticos or, you know, enormous acres of glass. They look like, yeah, they look really relatable. It's a really, really, really relatable book.
I think it's really useful. If you're doing any kind of reno, that I think that's worth having a read through so you understand a little bit more about how to make the space you've got work for you.
Oh, she's got a whole page here on kitchen islands, larders and utility spaces.
Well, you better read that quick because you're about to put one in and you might want to change your plans.
This is what I mean. This is perfect for where I'm at now, remodeling my home as it is and also having to compromise. So I can't design my house from a blueprint of exact. I mean, she talks about the door. When you open your front door, it should give your guests an immediate idea of flow of how to enter your house. My door doesn't do that at all. It sends them off to the left when actually the new kitchen's going to be to the right. But I can't do anything about that. If this is an old house that's been fudged together and so many of us live in those houses. But I got the feeling from Laura that doesn't matter. It's just change what you can and be aware of what doesn't work and what you therefore need to get the builders in to sort out or just put up with it the way it is. And I think the fact that my door opens the one way is going to be one thing I'm going to have to live with. But it is slightly annoying.
Can you not change the hinges?
No, because you kind of, if I change it the other way, then you don't really end up in the hall at all. It's not ideal. The door is opposite the footwell of the stairs. So the door is actually, it's the door that's in the wrong place. Actually, and I won't be moving where my front door is.
You're not going to move your staircase? Because they did do quite a lot of that on Your Home Made Perfect, I seem to recall. They were forever moving staircases, which is a big deal,
to be fair. I haven't got the courage to talk to Tom about moving the staircase. I think he might throw himself out of the hole.
Of the new
hole that is in our bedroom right now. Yeah, let's not do
There's
that.
There's not even a window. No, exactly. he could just lean back into the void. He's done.
Can't handle it any longer. Yeah.
Yes. Moving on from that. Our last book for this show is Interior Design Masters, written by the interior stylist Joanna Thornhill, who's written a few books, and it's called A Practical Guide to Decorating Your Home. And this is
It's a tome.
This is a tome, isn't it? It's small, but it's dense.
It's like Sport Billy's bag. So for all the 70s kids out there, remember watching a show called Sports Billy. Sports Billy had a bag and it was a sports bag. It was just like a really small bag. But everything came out of it. And I felt like this book is really small, but my gosh, there's an avalanche of information inside.
It's not a sort of coffee table book of the show. In fact, there's only illustrations of rooms that have been in the last couple of series.
It's hugely practical. And what I think, Joanna, I mean, this girl needs she needs a medal. She has put everything in here. There's colour theory, there's planning, there's layout, there's lighting, there's styling, there's a look at all the different design styles, signature styles. She talks about fabric, pattern, fireplaces, flooring, mood boarding. Oh, do you know what I mean?
It's almost like a dictionary of interior design, isn't it? So you've got reimagining vintage, shopping for vintage, savvy shopping, mixing brands and styles, maximal, minimal, boho, Scandi, rustic. You sort of want to pick a style from the index, I think, and learn about it. It's not one that you're going to read through front to back.
Yeah, I'm not compelled to read it front to back either. It doesn't feel like it's a book to do that job. I think treat it like a dictionary or an encyclopedia. Use the glossary, use the menu at the front to hone in, and that she will answer your question. There's no two ways about it. And not only that, which I think is really lovely, is they've sewn through loads of quotes from obviously Michelle, who's the head judge on the show, but also guest judges, myself included. I think you'll find a couple of quotes from me in there, as well as contestants of the show, all giving their own little pearls of wisdom. And I think this is what's really at the heart of this book and at the heart of the show is Interior Design Masters, which is a TV show over here in the UK on BBC One. For anyone who, sorry for our overseas listeners who can't watch it, you can now buy the book. What it is it's creating a really inclusive space because the contestants aren't always fully professional interior designers. Some of them have had some training, but it's about opening our arms up and including everybody into the world of interior design. So I think with that in mind, wherever you are on your interior design journey, if you're just starting out, if you're a renter, if you want to be a stylist, if you want to take it professionally, you will find something for you in this book.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, and it's got, just because we were talking about a book completely dedicated to the 70s, there is a chapter on decor by period, and that can be a really good way to get you started. You know, this is what Georgian is, this is how to get the look, this is Victorian and how to get the look, this is Art Deco, mid-century modern 70s. So it gives you a really good introduction to lots of different things, which you may want to explore in more depth later, but it's a really good overview of pretty much every period, every style, what it is, how to get it, how to be inspired by it, and then, you know, decorate for the mood you want. It's a good encyclopedia.
Now, before we wrap up this week's show, just one final reminder to you all about the Great Indoors Insiders. We'd love you to join our club. And when you sign up, you get ad-free listening and bonus content.
Not to mention first dibs on tickets for upcoming live events. And soon we will have news of a trip to Italy that you can come on with us.
Just simply go to the website, thegreatindoorspodcast.com.
In the meantime, you can follow me on Mad About the House and Sophie at Sophie Robinson Interiors. And if you have any design dilemmas, then email us or send us a voice note to help@thegreatindoorspodcast.com.
All that remains is for us to thank our lovely sponsors, Causton Architectural Detail, and our producer, Sarah Cadden of Feast Collective.
And we'll see you in the great indoors.